The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hello and welcome back to what was once the Seth Leibson Show and is now the Hallman Autonomous Zone here on 960 The Patriot, KKNT. I am joined today by the man, the myth, the legend, former mayor of Tempe, current attorney and patriarch of our house, Hugh Hallman. I am Lewis Hallman, the managing director of Insight Analytics, LLC.
You'd think I paid him or raised him to give me that good an introduction. We are delighted to be with you this afternoon. Later in this hour, we're going to be joined by Andy Biggs. He's an Arizona native who is serving his second term in the U.S. House. He is a wonderful fellow, served us for a very long time in our legislature, and we'll look to talk to him at the bottom of the hour. But we'd like to take a few calls. So how about we'll start with Dave in Surprise. Dave, what do you got?
Well, what an honor to enter into the house. I appreciate everything you're doing, Mr. Mayor, and Lewis as well.
Make sure you wear your hazmat suit.
Very appropriate, yes. Pun intended, I'm sure.
Well, I'm the has-been, so go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, well, I've been singing your praises for weeks on Twitter, sharing the information about how I think the state's cooking the books by eliminating the excess beds, which lowers the denominator. Of course, positive tests go up as we, positive cases go up as we increase testing. Of course, they misrepresent the timing of all those positive cases, it seems. I'm not as politically savvy as either of you, so I think at this point, based on what Representative Osborne mentioned, Governor Ducey has to be either A, complicit with this, or in his position, he's negligent for not being able to listen to people with a well-rounded grasp of these statistics and how they've been misleading. And unfortunately, I think he's misdirected what the state's plan should be moving forward. More people will die from poverty than die from this disease. I think that'll be statewide, nationwide, and globally. And I think people are ignoring those facts, unfortunately.
Well, Dave, thank you for calling in. And certainly, I think you've heard us agree with the notion that while we're worrying about deaths here, and we don't want to understate that, we don't want any Americans, we don't want any visitors to the United States to be put in harm's way, but we do know who's at risk. And money is fungible, but it's not unlimited, meaning that you can spend a dollar once, but you can't spend it twice. And by not focusing our resources and our efforts on the places where we know we will get the most out of that money, we squander that money. I will tell you, I don't think the governor is negligent or complicit. I think he's got staff members, this is not unusual, who are not serving him well. And I hope that he will listen to folks now giving him advice that he's got to get a broader base of information so he can have choices on how to analyze and understand the data.
So, Dave, my entire career as an analyst has been focused around supporting executive decision making. And, you know, being in the big chair is a really awfully hard job because you are utterly dependent upon what those close to you give you because you cannot source and process all of the data yourself. And so I do agree that Hugh that or Dad, depending on how we formally want to do this, that negligence is perhaps too strong a word. I think that he ought to be more aggressive in pursuit of alternate sources of information that can then either validate or challenge what it is he's seeing on a day-to-day basis.
Thank you, Dave, for the call. We'd like to go to Roger, who's in Phoenix. Roger, what's up?
Well, I'm on you guys' side as far as this closing down stuff. I was listening to somebody on a radio, and it was one of the state legislators here last week or the week before. They were talking about his when he had kind of said he was going to do it again. And the radio guy said, does he have the power to do this? And the guy said he does once. There's a state law that allows him to declare an emergency and issue executive orders like this, but that emergency can only last 30 days and cannot be renewed. He said, because during that 30 days, the legislature is supposed to get in session and pass rulings as to what's going to happen with all of this. So I don't know if you guys knew about that or not, but I'm still trying to figure out. I'm kind of thinking that's what the gym guy.
Yeah, so we've got cases that are getting filed against the state for the closures. And in fact, we'll be talking about that at the 5 o'clock hour with Dr. Jasser. He's been talking about that quite a lot. And we thought he's about as good as anybody, both a medical expert. He's a physician, but also he's pretty savvy in politics. So we'll be talking about that. In fact, Roger, if you went out onto the web, you can find this. It is a case, McGee versus the City of Flagstaff. It was decided just about a month ago. Murray Snow, the district judge, ruled, in fact, that our governor had the power to choose between restaurants and bars and whether or not certain people were being harmed in not having their jobs back. But what I found fascinating about that particular decision is that the state argued, in fact, that the person wasn't hurt because the governor's order didn't have any teeth to it. I kid you not, the state argued in their pleadings and the court ruled that effectively the governor's orders at that time were nearly meaningless. Now, this new order is not meaningless. It certainly has some teeth in it, and it threatens to make sure that people understand that if they don't comply, the city's police officers and others can swoop in and do what they need to do. In fact, in this instance, the governor's order says that local government jurisdictions shall have the authority to take immediate action against an entity that operates without submitting prescribed attestation to the Arizona Department of Health Services that they're in compliance. And the executive order allows law enforcement and any regulatory agency pursuant to their regulatory authority to take immediate enforcement action against any business that fails to follow the executive order or any guidance issued by the Arizona Department of Health Services. So that's a pretty big hammer. And he calls out in his closure of bars this time, unlike the prior series, he called out that it's any bar that uses a Series 6 or Series 7 liquor license. Those are the licenses that you get if you want to operate a broad bar operation. And you may recall he got into some hot water last month when he called out bars and said that you're risking your liquor license if you don't comply with his order. And that's what gave rise to some of these original lawsuits. And again, Judge Murray Snow said, nah, nobody's hurt because the orders don't really mean anything. The newest one and the newest round of lawsuits, I think, are going to have some different consequences. For the reasons you raise, the two statutes that the governor's operating under are fairly specific, and they have fairly specific requirements for the state and the governor to meet. And you're correct. At some point, the governor's got to bring the legislature back in session to stamp the imprimatur on his authority.
So I'm a statistician, and so the legalese is about as clear to me as the numbers are to you.
He's pointing to me.
Yes. Not to you, Roger, but to my dad here.
Your old dad.
And so I would answer that question in a slightly different way. I would note that there are two kinds of power. There's hard power, you know, that actually falls in the statutes and the like, and then there's soft power that is sort of the basis of trust and competence and respect that we all have in those laws. And so while it may be the case that the governor has the hard power to be able to do this, I am increasingly skeptical of the soft power side of things. I am not sure that there is much will, especially if we expand these series of restrictions to a full-blown shutdown. I am very doubtful that there is the political will left in the state of Arizona to endure more of this, particularly as we see hospitalization rates collapse and case fatality rates collapse.
So, in fact, we'll chat about that in a little bit. But the point is that there are a series of statutes that the governor's operating under, And I think I agree with Lewis. At some point when you're using that hard power and that huge brickbat, you're going to lose the support of the people. And in this instance, I think we're seeing the result of the loss of trust in our government. The governor is now begging people to wear masks and undertake other behaviors that might reduce the spread. That's not unreasonable. The problem is that people aren't complying because they've heard it before. And that's a shame that we have undermined or seen undermined the authority and position of our state and our governor. The governor is a good person, and he needs to be supported by people who help him craft the right messages and institute the right kinds of actions that people can believe in. We've had leaders rally us to give our lives for this nation. And so it shouldn't be that much an ask to get people to wear masks. You're listening to KKNT 960 The Patriot, the Seth Leibson Show, and we look forward to talking to you in a few minutes.
Welcome back to 960 The Patriot here at KKNT. My father misspoke when we left you off. This is no longer the Seth Leibson Show. This is now the Holman Autonomous Zone as we protest Seth Leibson's overwork, the innumeracy of government, and the futility of universal solutions to targeted problems. I am Lewis Holman, the Managing Director of Insight Analytics. He is the former mayor of Tempe, Hugh Holman.
The political has-been, I guess is what he's trying to say. Thank you for coming back with us, folks. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to be speaking with Andy Biggs. He is the in his second term as the representative in Arizona's Congressional District 5. And we look forward to talking to him about an editorial he wrote. He's been discussing these issues in state quite a bit, and I think has given it a lot of great thought. We look forward to speaking to Congressman Biggs shortly. Why don't we take Bob, who's been hanging on the line from Phoenix. Bob?
Hi, how are you doing?
We're doing great. You wanted to talk about Sweden.
Yes, but I also wanted to say Andy Biggs is great. I support him 100%. But anyway, yes, I was talking to a liberal friend of mine, and I was saying to him, I did not really support the lockdown. I think there's going to be more negative consequences from it. And he brought up Sweden, look what happens there, and their murder rate or their death rate and all that stuff. Is there any way to get, you guys are big on statistics, is there any way to get accurate information to say, hey, this is what they did, this is their numbers compared to the world, United States,
Arizona? Absolutely, Bob. In fact, let me start with this. I have to give Sweden a little credit. It is one of the leftier countries in Europe. But it stood up against the folks who were insisting that it close down. And in fact, Sweden took a very modest approach to this in contrast to the surrounding countries. And it took a lot of heat in the liberal press for not playing along with the narrative that you've got to close down. That said, Sweden's a country of about 10 million people. Lewis, what are your stats on it?
So Sweden is about the same population as Georgia. It has
the state of Georgia, not the country of Georgia.
That's correct. So as my numbers are a couple days out of date, so forgive me on that. This is as of June 29th, Sweden had a total of 5,280 total deaths, whereas Georgia, at the same point,
the state of Georgia,
state of Georgia, not the country, had a total of 2,778 deaths. So the state of Georgia had about half the death rate of Sweden. That's not necessarily a fair comparison entirely. Sweden is a fairly old demographically country. It's so we should really look at it in comparison to its neighbors. So if you want to think about population weighted statistics, so we can really compare apples to apples. Or old people to old people. Sweden has 523 deaths per million. If you compare that with the United Kingdom, for instance, which had much more stringent lockdowns led by Professor Neil Ferguson of Imperial College London, they have 642 deaths per million.
Give us the numbers again. So 642 for Great Britain
versus 523 for Sweden. That would
so
be
Sweden had a much lighter touch going in and had fewer deaths per million compared to Great Britain.
Right. The Swedish death rate is also less than the Italian death rate, which stands
well,
at
that's not really saying much because that's one
fair.
Of the worst.
575 and the Spanish death rate at 606. These places are some of the worst places in the world because they're demographically old. But I also note that their large series of restrictions that they placed on themselves didn't have as good an effect as what seems to have happened in Sweden, which is very curious, I would think, and does say something about the efficacy of lockdowns and the cost of unintended consequences.
In fact, what our biggest complaint about what's been going on in the press is that they like to report the ugliest and worst information. If it bleeds, it leads, completely out of context. And so we get lots of announcement of new cases with no corresponding discussion of the number of tests that have taken place. We've talked about this before, Bob, that if you had 10 tests taken and three people turned up to have the disease and you had three positive tests, if you went out and took 20 people and tested them and ended up with five, it is true you'd have a 60% increase in tests in cases.
66% increase.
All right. Thank you, Lou. 66% increase in cases. And yet it's actually good news because you doubled the number of your tests, but your total number of results fell. And unfortunately, the press continues to beat the drum that more cases is bad. In fact, Lewis, why don't you put a little skin on that one?
Sure. So not only that, they refuse to give, when they're comparing states by states, they don't give any kind of population-weighted statistics. And additionally, the story has been changing over time. It used to be deaths per day, but because across the United States, deaths have been declining significantly since May 1st, that we're not hearing that anymore. It's all case record, case record, case record, and just gibbering about, you know, any big number that they can find to keep us panicked and compliant.
Yeah, but for example, the Arizona statistics now, the numbers are showing a different trend in deaths and in hospitalization.
That's very, very true. So we are seeing an increase in Arizona. We're seeing over the past month or so, we are seeing more deaths per day. We're seeing more cases per day, even despite the fact that testing has increased analogously. But the issue is that many of these states that they're now talking about, Texas, Arizona, Florida, and the like, did not have significantly large outbreaks during the initial crisis. When we saw literally hundreds of deaths per day in New Jersey, we've never gotten that. The most we've ever had, according to AZDHS as of today, is 33 deaths attributed to one day.
The real point, I think, is that as more and more cases are being revealed, it's in part because more and more tests are being done. We've expanded the testing base. And as a result, as more and more people are getting tested, you're seeing more people who are asymptomatic or low symptomatic. And as a result, the hospitalization rate from cases is falling. So as we get more and more cases announced, that's missing the point. As cases are announced, you look at how many of those people ended up in the hospital. And Lou?
So if you look at the total hospitalization rate over the course of the pandemic, we're looking at about 5.4% of any people who get sick end up in the hospital, irrespective of age. If you look at the statistics recently, that number is closer to 3.6% without correcting for the fact that we're still missing many, many confirmed cases that will be revealed over the next week or so.
And those cases are, you know, somebody's in the hospital, you know, somebody's died. The issue is cases are, or rather tests are being revealed slower than deaths and hospitalizations. So we find out that data over a longer period of time. And what it tends to do is push the shocking numbers from the early days down. And so, as Lewis just explained to you, the rate of hospitalization of people who end up showing the disease is actually falling.
Same is true of the case fatality rate. If you look at the total pandemic, you know, from the beginning to now, we see a case fatality rate of about 1.58%.
Down from
5 or 10% in the early days of the pandemic. But in fact, if you look over the last 2 weeks, the case fatality rate is 0.7%.
So this has fallen to half just in the last 2 weeks. We are honored and privileged to have Arizona Congressman Andy Biggs joining us at the bottom of the hour. We look forward to that. He is a lifelong resident, a native of Arizona, and he's got some really sharp thoughts on how the state has responded to this crisis. You are listening to The Seth Leibson Show. I'm Hugh Hallman. That's Lewis Hallman. It's KKNT 960, The Patriot. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I'm Hugh Hallman, joined by Lewis Hallman. And more importantly, we have with us an Arizona native who's serving his second term as our representative in Arizona's 5th District. What is amazing is I can believe that Andy Biggs has served for 14 years in the legislature and now 4 years in Congress. You can believe that just looking at his picture. But his bride of 38 years looks significantly younger than he does. So, Congressman, welcome to the show and explain that one.
You know, I'm a lucky man, and she is beautiful, and she's on a plane coming back to D.C. tonight, so that's good.
Excellent. Well, I think it means that you're a good husband because your bride of 38 years looks like she's only just 38, so she's had a good life so far, and your children and 6 grandchildren, your 6 kids and grandkids, everybody's fine, everybody's good?
Everybody's fine, everybody's good.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us. The reason we wanted to bring you onto the show is because you have authored an editorial called, it's at least titled, Arizona's Governor's Shutdown Order Defies Reason, and it ran today in Town Hall, and we'd like to welcome you to the show to talk about the point of your editorial.
Thanks, Hugh. It's good to be, it's great to be with you. I haven't talked to you in a while, so it's good to be with you. Yeah, so I wrote that in response to just what I'm seeing here. I go through the Arizona data every day. I go through a lot of other data from other locations. I go through a lot of conversations that I have with people on the ground, and I'm kind of baffled by the step backward that we're taking.
It strikes me, and I think you give voice to this in the editorial, that we've got a liberal media beating the drum very, very hard, and it has been pointed at 3 states particularly in the last 2 weeks, Florida, Texas, and Arizona. They all share one thing in common that I think makes the difference, and that is they have Republican governors. And they are Republican governors who demonstrated leadership different from what the narrative has been chosen by the press. And I think you make that point. What's your sense about what the governor's done and what we now need to try to do?
Well, first of all, that is right. That is the point. Governor Ducey's been under intense pressure from the left, from local and national politicians, as well as from the media. But I want to just take a look at just some data, and I put a bunch of data in the column because I think it's just important to put things in context. Because what everybody's focusing on, quite frankly, are 2 numbers. They're talking about the actual confirmed cases on a day by day basis, how they've increased. So, for instance, a few days ago we hit over 4,000. That's over a week ago now. But nonetheless, that was a high point in our history, in the state's history, dealing with COVID. And the other thing that they use is the hospitalizations, and what do we have there? And so they start looking at what is the availability of ICU beds. Well, it's about 11% of those beds are available. How about inpatient? Well, about 15%. And then you start looking at hospitalizations. And so when you start looking at this, what you're going to see is that we are discharging patients more than we are bringing in on a daily basis, and that's a good thing. The ratio of hospitalizations to positive testing has dropped from 3 weeks ago, a little over 11.5%, down to just under 6% or 6%.
In fact, Congressman, our analysis, which we do on a daily basis, Lewis downloads the data. His most recent assessment for the statewide hospitalization has dropped to...
I think the congressman's figures are accurate. My analysis is against the net change in hospital beds, which increases more slowly than the overall change in hospital beds.
And so you've got a congressman who's got the data and is analyzing it more carefully, I fear, and not fear, I'm grateful for, than the governor's staff. And I think we need to push the governor to get some additional voices in his head about this data, because your point is a great one. And that is, you've got, if you include all beds, you've got greater capacity than the press is reporting. Congressman, we'd like you to come back immediately after the break. You able to stay with us?
Yes, I'll stay with you.
Super. We'll be back with Congressman Andy Biggs, congressman from Arizona's 5th Congressional District, lifelong Arizonan, a native, not many of us out there, married 38 years, not many of those either, 6 children, 6 grandchildren, a wonderful human being, served us for 14 years in our legislature with, as I recall, Mr. Biggs, that was 4 years as Senate president, wasn't it?
That is correct, sir.
That's a man with a resume that we can admire. We'll be right back with Congressman Andy Biggs. You're listening to KKNT 960 The Patriot, The Seth Liebson Show. I'm Hugh Hallman, joined by Lewis Hallman and our great Congressman Andy Biggs. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. I'm Hugh Hallman, joined by Lewis Hallman. And more importantly, we are joined by Arizona native and Congressman Andy Biggs from our 5th Congressional District. Congressman, we're delighted you could join us and raise the issues that you've been talking about with respect to government response to the whole COVID crisis.
I had a question, actually, Congressman, if I may.
Yes.
There's nothing that I find more admirable and indicative of moral courage than the willingness to stand alone. And I noticed that you were one of only, I believe, 7 congressmen in the entire nation to vote against the CARE Act. Have you felt any consequences or any blowback from this?
No, you know, Lewis, that's a great question. My constituents trust me. They asked me why. Some of them, not everybody's of the same party. Some of them were not happy. But when I explained to them a whole plethora of reasons why, most of them understand it. They understand what's happening there. And I cannot tell you how, surprisingly to me, how many people expressed gratitude. So that's the good fortune of living in a district where people try to stay really informed on these issues.
Well, not everybody's had the chance to really understand the philosophy behind the vote you cast. Do you mind sort of sharing your approach?
Yeah, so the first thing you do is you find out what all is in there. Now, there are some things that I would have supported as standalone, but they didn't make it a standalone bill. They made this a multi-trillion dollar bill that we, with no attempt to even provide pay for us. And this was done very quickly without even an opportunity to discuss. And so we were trying to parse this thing. They gave us, it was like, I want to say 15 hours to go through the bill. And we started my team and we called other offices and we were all split in duty trying to go through the bill. And as you went through the bill, you found that we were doing things like funding the Lincoln Center with millions of dollars, and the Lincoln Center had just furloughed all of their employees, and yet you were giving Lincoln Center money. You were giving money to the Peace Corps, and you were sending a billion-plus dollars overseas to other to another country altogether. And you started looking at this, and you said, we're supposed to be, ostensibly, we're going to be telling people we're going to provide PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, but that's only a small portion of what we're doing. And you're also, think of this, and this is, I cannot tell you how many times I hear this from people today, even I had multiple calls today. In that bill was also this portion of it that said, if you're unemployed, the federal government will give you $600 bonus per week above whatever the state's giving you for your unemployment. So we have people in Arizona today who are making more on unemployment than they were, even if they were making $14 an hour prior to losing their jobs through furlough. So their companies have tried to bring them back. Well, some of us mentioned that. We argued for that to be changed because you provide this wicked economic disincentive so that we knew that we'd be opening up at some point, and you wanted people to be incentivized to go back to work because that's ostensibly why you had the Paycheck Protection Program in the first place. So you see there's a whole boatload of reasons why you would look at that and say, this doesn't do what it's supposed to do. And we're actually seeing that play out over and over again. And the reality is we've just increased our national structural deficit by about $3 trillion in the last 65 days.
That's about 73% of the entire federal budget in the year 2019, I believe. That's, it's an unfathomable amount of yes. money to me. Congressman, if I were in your district, you would have my boat forever because of that decision. So,
and Lewis is not easy, I must tell you. But in fact, it was Lewis who did a little analysis for us, Congressman, that you might find useful. He put pen to paper and inflation adjusted the entire amount of money that the U.S. spent on World War II, including the money it provided to foreign nations for their weaponry and other things. And it doesn't include post-war Marshall Plan kinds of things. But in that period, we spent about $4.5 trillion. And the bill you were just talking about spent $3 trillion, 66% of the amount of money that we spent on the entirety of World War II. And in that period of time, you had the greatest generation providing its treasure, providing 600,000 American lives in order to preserve freedom. And here we sit. In 90 days, we spent 66% of that amount of treasure and gave up liberty in order to save our lives. It seems a little perverse that we've lost the native notion of what it means to be an American.
Yeah, and I would just add an additional dark cloud above that. The House just passed out today a $1.5 trillion infrastructure package with no mechanism to pay for that. And by the way, a permanent reauthorization of the funding, there is some funding in there. So reauthorization of the funding and reauthorization of hundreds of billions of dollars of spending there without Congress ever having to come back to it. And then you add in the phase four that they're talking about now, which is somewhere between $1 and $2 trillion. You have the horrific potential of having a structural deficit before the end of September of somewhere north of $7 trillion. And when I say structural deficit, I mean that's the difference between your spending amount and how much that exceeds your total revenue. Imagine that, $7 trillion. And economists tell me that will naturally inure to create at least a $2.5 trillion structural deficit next year. These are things that keep me awake at night. And the reality is, Hugh, you and I, if this trend continues, we will never face the brunt of that. It is our children and our grandchildren that are going to face the economic consequences ultimately of that.
In fact, I'm grateful for your calling out these kinds of issues, because in our lifetimes, we've watched our government spend increasing amounts of money, not in any way, shape, or form concern itself with the deficits that are mounting. And my son Lewis, sitting across the studio, is mouthing a great scream because he knows we have now saddled him and his brothers and their families with these debts, just as you know that your children and grandchildren have been settled with them.
This is going to be the greatest, this is frankly the greatest transfer of wealth in human history. And my fear is that, you know, my generation and every generation behind us now is going to have this enormous albatross around our necks forever.
Well, Congressman, you also mentioned in your editorial the point about trying to get our kids back into school. I think it may be the one best opportunity we have to try to rework our education system and teach them the lessons you're talking about. What drove you to talk about the education piece and getting kids back into schools?
Well, that's one thing that I hear about from constituents, from regardless of their political persuasion. And we're hearing that nationwide. Parents want their kids in school. I'm sometimes dubious about whether they're being indoctrinated or taught. But the bottom line is, we need to give them the basic core of education. And there's been damage done already, according to pediatricians, American Academy of Pediatricians. There'll be continued emotional and mental damage. When I say damage, I mean a delay in development if these kids aren't able to get into school.
Congressman, thank you for joining us today. Thank you for your great work. Appreciate your editorial very much. I'm Hugh Hallman. He's Lewis Hallman. We've been joined by Andy Biggs, the congressman from Arizona's 5th District, a native Arizonan who's out there fighting for you on a daily basis.
And a bastion of moral courage.
We'll be back in just a minute.
Thank you.
Boy, it is tough to beat that musician. Welcome back to the Seth Liebson Show. I'm Hugh Hallman, joined by Lewis Hallman. We just got off the phone with Congressman Andy Biggs, who I think may have disturbed Lewis more than anything I've seen, and it's not because he's not a great congressman, but because
he told us that we may be facing a $7 trillion deficit before the end of the year here. That's not the total budget, the deficit.
So put that in context, Lewis.
$7 trillion is a stack of $100 bills about 4,000 miles high. That would be longer than the entire length of the continental United States.
And sort of in terms of GDP?
That's a third of our gross domestic product, a third of all economic activity produced in this country as the deficit, not the debt, the deficit. That will all have to be made up and paid back later with future tax earnings. This is going to haunt us forever.
So as we heard Congressman Biggs note, that means that the additional cost of that debt when paid over time is likely to amount to about a $2.5 trillion additional load on our economy. So you're really looking at something closing on $10 trillion.
About 5,500 miles high of $100 bills, yeah.
Well, there you go. See, I can't do that kind of math in my head there, son. He did mention that the American Academy of Pediatricians has been raising the alarm about the fact that we've closed our schools and kids are now being put at risk. This is not some crazy right-wing wacko organization. This is the American Academy of Pediatricians. And what they specifically write in a 19-page paper about how schools can get open and what we should do about them is this. The AAP strongly advocates that all policy considerations for the coming school year should start with a goal of having students physically present in school. This paper is talking about all the reasons we need to get our kids back to class for their well-being, but we can throw in the fact that it would also help our families' well-being. Ladies and gentlemen, we look forward to coming back at the top of the hour with Dr. Zudi Jasser to talk about health clubs. And why is it that we've been closing them? Dr. Jasser has been spending some time thinking about writing about this problem. We look forward to talking to him. You're listening to Hugh Hallman and Lewis Hallman. This is KKNT 960, The Patriot. We're filling in for Seth Liebson, who's taking a little bit of well-deserved time. We look forward to chatting with you shortly. We'll see you right back.